Historical Blindness, the Odd Past podcast. In this episode, we will continue our exploration of the lost colony of Roanoke with an examination of what may be the most outrageous archaeological find or hoax of the last century. If you did not listen to the previous episode, please do so before continuing to this, part two of The Lost Colony and the Dare Stones. In 1937, nearly 350 years after John White's discovery of the colony's disappearance, the story of the lost colony jumped suddenly back into the national consciousness with the discovery of a remarkable artifact. This item, a rock, was brought to Emory University of Atlanta by one Lewis E. Hammond, a man purporting to be a tourist from California. This stone, which carried a mysterious engraved message, immediately captured the interest of history professor Haywood Pierce, for this stone's inscription appeared to be a message from none other than Eleanor Dare. On its face, beneath a cross, significantly a Latin cross with one arm longer than the other, rather than the Maltese cross with arms of equal length, which had been the agreed-upon signal to indicate the colony had gone inland, was carved the message, "Ananias Dare and Virginia went hence unto heaven, 1591. Any Englishman show John White, Governor, Virginia." On the reverse side of this stone, which you can view in this episode's blog entry, a longer message was carved in Elizabethan English, this one harder to make out for its Middle English orthography and the fact that both A's and O's seem to appear as rough-hewn dots. I'll read this in modern English for clarity, but the website will present an exact transcription. "Father, soon after you go for England, we came hither. Only misery and war 2 year. Above half dead ere 2 year more from sickness, being 24. Savage with message of ship unto us. Small space of time, they affright of revenge ran all away. We believe it not you. Soon after, ye savages feign spirits angry. Sudden murder all save 7. Mine child, Ananias too, slain with much misery. Bury all near 4 miles east this river upon small hill. Names writ all there on rock. Put this there also. Savage show this unto you, and hither we promise you to give great plenty presents." This message was signed EWD, presumably for Eleanor White Dare. The stone told a clear enough story. Soon after White left them, the colonists came hither, presumably to the place the stone had been found, and suffered misery and war for 2 years, losing more than half their number to illness within another 2 years. We are given the number 24, though it seems unclear whether that represents the number who expired or survived. It sounds as if it is the number dead, but this would not be, quote-unquote, above half the number left behind, so Pierce read it as the number who survived. Thereafter, a savage or Native American reported to the surviving colonists that a ship approached, and this caused some fear of revenge that drove the natives to flee, even though the colonists apparently did not believe the ship to belong to their countrymen. Afterward, supposedly driven by angry spirits or simply in an angry mood, the natives massacred the remaining colonists, leaving only 7 alive. Eleanor reports that her child, Virginia, and husband, Ananias, were among those slain, whom they buried around 4 miles east of this river, presumably meaning the river near which the stone had been discovered, on a hill where they'd left another stone, this one a grave marker inscribed with the names of the dead. The message ends by explaining that this stone had been given to a native to give to White, or as the reverse side indicates, to give it unto any Englishman, who would then show it to White, on the promise that the native messenger would be rewarded with gifts upon delivering it, a problematic detail to which we shall return. The find, if genuine, was a monumental discovery, but Pierce and his colleagues, wary of hoaxes, examined it and questioned its discoverer, Lewis E. Hammond, closely. Hammond was a tourist out of California. By one report, a seller of produce, Hammond claimed to have stopped along a newly built causeway in swamplands along the Chowan River in North Carolina to hunt for hickory nuts. These swamps had for many years been inaccessible, and even rumored to be a pirate haunt in days of yore. Thus, when Hammond tripped over the 21-pound piece of quartz and saw its inscription, he thought perhaps it represented a clue to the resting place of buried treasure and took it with him. 2 months later, he arrived at Emory University in Atlanta, seeking a translator. Pierce and his colleagues saw no evidence of fraud in the stone, noting that its inscription might have been made with tools available to colonists, and that its message appeared consistent, idiomatically and orthographically, with Elizabethan English. Therefore, they followed this mysterious Hammond to the place where he claimed to have found the stone. Hammond took them to the causeway and whipped out a crude map scrawled on a paper bag. But to their chagrin, November rains made it impossible for him to pinpoint the site where he had pulled it from the ground. Frustrated in his search, Hammond led them to a sandbar. There, an old sunken barge marked the place where he had supposedly washed the stone. And not only washed it, but scrubbed it with a wire brush and accentuated the lettering using a pencil. These misguided efforts of Hammond's were later blamed for the inability to properly assess how long the stone had lain in the swamp. Pierce remained skeptical, but feeling that the stone warranted further investigation, he hoped to find the grave marker alluded to in its description as a verification of its authenticity. There is, however, at least to my understanding, an error in logic here. The stone referred to a grave east this river, as if the Dare Stone was meant to remain in one location, presumably there on the western side of the Chowan, and act as a guide to the grave marker on the hill. And then it says, put this there also, which wouldn't make sense with the previous statement. And then, savage show this unto you, indicating the stone had been given to a native as a message to be given over to any Englishman. This appears wholly nonsensical. If it were meant to stay by the river and point any who came across it to the other side of the river and the grave, then it would defeat the purpose to place this stone also at the grave, or to instruct natives to carry it away from that spot to an Englishman in exchange for gifts. None of these inconsistencies appear to have occurred to Pierce, though, as he seems to have been far too excited over the prospect of finding the grave to consider such contradictions. Unfortunately, though, as he was embarking on his quest for the gravesite, rumors had already begun to swirl that he had actually already discovered Virginia Dare's grave. In an effort to quash these reports, he published a translation of the stone in January of the next year. Thereafter, the former mayor of Edenton, a town near the purported discovery site of the stone, wrote Pierce with a tantalizing anecdote. As a young man, he had performed logging work in the swamps east of the Chowan, just where the Dare Stone claimed the grave marker could be found. And incredibly, he recalled a remarkable moss-covered stone upon a hilltop that might have been the very marker Pierce sought. Of course, Pierce set out to find this rock, and on finding it, very carefully removed the moss to find nothing at all. Therefore, he began to excavate the hill, certain that he would find the resting place of the dead colonists, and in the process, he turned up no indication of remains whatsoever. Regardless of this dig's failure, Pierce was undeterred. And since his first media promotion of the investigation had resulted in a promising lead, he might be forgiven for thinking that further advertisement of his search might provide a real breakthrough. In hindsight, however, he surely regretted his subsequent decision to offer a $500 reward for any who could find or lead them to the grave marker in question. The story takes a careening turn then when William Eberhardt, an uneducated stoneworker, almost a year and a half after the arrival of the Dare Stone at Emory, approached Dr. Haywood Pierce with another find. This one purportedly found some 300 miles from the first. south and west, and one state over in South Carolina. The stone Eberhardt showed Pierce was inscribed with a much different style of script, and at first blush seemed unreadable, although a date, 1589, could be discerned. Pierce dismissed it as a Spanish gravestone, telling Eberhardt they would keep the stone and translate it, but that the reward they had offered was only for a stone that would be found near the Chowan River in North Carolina. Eberhardt, undaunted, returned with two more stones bearing the same date and supposedly found in the same region. One might imagine this trying Pierce's patience, as he explained to Eberhardt again that the stone he sought would not be found in South Carolina. Moreover, Pierce apparently explained to Eberhardt exactly what the date on the stone he sought would be, and therefore one might imagine that he very well could have shared some further details as to what would mark the Dare gravestone he wanted so desperately to find. Amazingly then, or perhaps predictably, Eberhardt returned with exactly the stone Pierce pursued. The stone Eberhardt brought him bore the following legend: "Here layeth Ananias and Virginia. Father, savage murder all save seven. Names written here, may God have mercy. Eleanor Dare, 1591. On the reverse surface were inscribed 15 names, which in combination with Ananias and Virginia Dare was exactly the number of dead Pierce expected to be memorialized by the grave marker. A triumph of luck and archaeology, it seemed. But what about the fact that Eberhardt still claimed to have found it so far from the first stone? Rationalization can scale any mountain, it seems, for Pierce simply changed his theory to accommodate, apparently reasoning that the first stone had been carried by its Indian bearer from South Carolina all the way to North Carolina in search of the promised Englishman who would trade great gifts for it. Never mind the east this river bit. Eberhardt certainly had Pierce's attention then. Upon interrogation, Eberhardt revealed his lack of education, which made him more trustworthy in Pierce's eyes, and explained that, by pure chance while traveling, he had discovered a site with multiple engraved stones resting in a gully at the base of a hill. He had taken only one with him as a curio, and had returned to recover others when Pierce had been uninterested in the first. Indeed, he claimed to have discovered 13 more stones there, and he produced all of them for Pierce. Of course, Pierce asked to be shown this site, and Eberhardt obliged, leading him into a rural area near the Saluda River, and showing him a depression in the ground where he said the stones had lain when he discovered them. What remained was to test the authenticity of the stones, and to test the veracity of Eberhardt. The stones passed scrutiny, although whether or not that scrutiny might have been cursory or deficient is hard to surmise at this historical distance. Pierce and the experts he consulted found Eberhardt's stones to bear what appeared to be authentically Elizabethan language. Moreover, their inscriptions in most of their particulars, such as the names mentioned, appeared to correspond with extant accounts from John White and John Smith. And finally, chemical tests to examine oxidation and weathering seemed to indicate that the stones were old, although how old could not then be determined, and, more importantly, that the cut surface within the engraved letters appeared to be equally weathered. Further convincing was Pierce's investigation of Eberhardt's background, which confirmed his lack of education and therefore the likelihood of his inability to accurately approximate Elizabethan English, and his lack of familiarity with relevant historical records that corroborated the names inscribed on the stones. The final indication to Pierce that Eberhardt was on the level came when the man passed a tricky test. Trying to catch Eberhardt out, Pierce suggested that, rather than accepting the promised $500 reward, Eberhardt take only $100 and a 50% stake in the property on which he had found all the stones, a piece of land that, if the stones proved authentic, would surely be worth far more in time. Eberhardt's decision to take the stake in the property seemed to confirm to Pierce that Eberhardt himself believed the stones to be genuine. He therefore made the deal, feeling more confident in the discovery, and subsequently sent Eberhardt out to find further stones in the South Carolina area and into Georgia. Since the stone with the colonists' names had a further message along the edge that read, "Father, we go SW or Southwest," which to me seems a clear effort by a forger to explain why the Eberhardt stones had been found hundreds of miles southwest of where Pierce expected to find them, Pierce hoped more stones would be found to the southwest of Eberhardt's Hill. The next stone to be found, however, was not turned up by Eberhardt, but by a resident of Atlanta named I.A. Turner, who claimed to have found the stone along the Chattahoochee southwest of the hill while hunting, contacting Pierce because of an Atlanta newspaper piece on the other stones. Turner's stone matched all of Eberhardt's in its script. Signed again by Eleanor, it appeared to indicate that more stones would be found by the same river. And sure enough, Eberhardt thereafter discovered 9 more stones along the Chattahoochee. And in the next year, as dozens of new stones were lugged in by various different people for scrutiny, the last vestiges of Pierce's skepticism were finally obliterated when an assemblage of Georgian farmers reported that they had seen such stones inscribed with what they had always believed were the writings of Native Americans up to 50 years earlier. One farmer, T.R. Jett, who had lived throughout his childhood in the area where these latest stones had been discovered, claimed to have seen 2 such stones in his youth, one of which had been displayed in his family's mill and widely remarked upon. While he could not recall what had become of those stones, the aforementioned I.A. Turner, the first to find a stone in Georgia besides Eberhardt, another local, claimed to recall where the stone had been discarded after its exhibition in the mill, and, fantastically, managed after so many years to find it for Pierce. The second stone from Jett's memory had apparently been hauled out of the river and split into 2 pieces, one of which had reportedly been used as part of a stone construction in a barn that no longer stood. Surely this fragmented stone could no longer be found. But no, with a little encouragement, Jett managed to find one half in a ditch and the other in an old tool chest. The pieces fitted together perfectly, and one might imagine this moment like a pivotal scene from a historical mystery thriller when the music swells and the outlandish theory is proven factual. In all, 48 Dare stones were discovered after the first, and 42 of them by Eberhardt. Always the stones were picked up with no witnesses around to confirm their discovery. But sometimes Eberhardt was able to show indentations in the ground that fit his finds. The inscribed story beyond the first stone was predictable at first, and then, before its conclusion, sensational. The stones indicated that some so-called savages had shown the colonists much mercy, whereas others, from the east, had massacred them. Talk of burying the dead was common. All the while, some effort was made to look for Governor White's return, a dubious claim considering how far inland these stones had supposedly been found. Thereafter, talk of a native king taking the surviving colonists in and taking Eleanor to wife seemed to take the narrative in a decidedly romantic direction. This narrative was not unfolded to Pierce in any linear fashion, as stones were found out of the chronological order of the story they had to tell, but eventually, all was pieced together. If the stones were to be believed, Eleanor Dare, after losing her husband and daughter to murder, married a native chieftain, lived with him, possibly in a cave, in quote-unquote primeval splendor, and eventually bore her new husband a child. Another daughter, whom, according to one stone, she named Agnes, and whom, according to another, she hoped her father would find and take back to England. Eventually, some conflict arose among the natives owing to the birth of the girl, but before that could be further explicated, the narrative resolved with an ominous remark upon Eleanor's sudden illness. This story in stones concluded with a date of 1599. When it might be presumed that Eleanor expired from some naturally arising ailment, although it might also be speculated that she was poisoned by those of the tribe who were upset over the birth of her daughter. Regardless of any conjecture this story might inspire, however, all theories arising from it were soon proven moot, for consensus regarding the authenticity of the stones was about to shift rather dramatically. After further study and corroboration by visiting professors hailing from institutions as storied as Harvard, Pierce wrote to the Saturday Evening Post regarding the stones, and the Post sent journalist Boyden Sparks down to Georgia to look into the matter. According to the article that Sparks eventually published in the spring of 1941, which has been quite useful in composing my own account of the affair, Sparks immediately found Pierce wary and even hostile, specifically when Sparks suggested that it stretched the imagination to believe a Native American might have been prevailed upon to lug a 21-pound stone around on the off chance he might be able to exchange it for goods sometime in the unforeseeable future. Sparks inquired about the university at Chapel Hill's lack of interest in the stones, and Pierce suggested that Paul Green, faculty at Chapel Hill and author of a popular play about the lost colony, was angry because filmmaker Cecil B. DeMille, who had been sniffing around Green for source material, had now turned his attentions to Pierce. Sparks very sharply pointed out that Hollywood's optioning of historical source material had become a big business, especially there in Georgia after the success of Gone with the Wind, and suggested that this entire affair of the Dare Stones may have been a scheme to draw Hollywood's attention, even going so far as suggesting that Hammond, the mysterious Californian, might have been a hoaxer on some Hollywood production company's payroll. Indeed, it seemed that someone had tried to sell a stone at Manteo, where Green's play was put on, long before Hammond ever showed up at Emory. According to Sparks's article, a local senator remembered some huckster who came through the area promoting a real estate project and a coastal highway had outright suggested the creation of bogus relics using old ballast stones. Among the other schemes this out-of-towner had brainstormed were carving Croatoan on a log and sinking it out where fishermen would pull it up in their nets, or claiming to find one of Governor White's buried chests. According to Sparks, who says he tracked down records of this mysterious man kept by the administrators of that coastal highway, this stranger had even been caught filming Paul Green's play with a handheld camera on opening night and been asked to cease and desist. But perhaps most discrediting is that Sparks claims Pierce knew about this suspicious story, yet still gave weight to Hammond and his stone. Sparks further debunks the notion that various unaffiliated farmers independently corroborated the existence of the stones found in Georgia. According to his article, Eberhardt was close friends with all the other finders of the Georgia stones, and the Jett family, who purported to remember the stones in their mill, was also acquainted with Eberhardt through his companions. In fact, while Pierce averred that Mr. Jett easily identified the stone from memory, Sparks' interview with Mr. Jett suggests that the man actually made the identification under rather strange circumstances and with no small amount of coaching. It seems Jett had shot his landlord with a shotgun, and it was while being held in jail that he was approached by Pierce and shown the stone through the bars of his cell. Jett did not identify it immediately, as Pierce indicated, but did so after getting out of jail, and Sparks implies that Pierce may have helped him in some wise. Jett's remembrances are further made dubious by his claim that he never could read the Indian writing on the stones in his youth, whereas the stones he identified are clearly inscribed with English lettering. Sparks' working theory was that the Jett stones were purposely inscribed with G's, carved to resemble the figure eights mentioned in some witness accounts of old stone relics that probably did at some point exist. Moreover, Sparks went himself to examine the tool chest in which Mrs. Jett reportedly found the half a stone that fit perfectly with the other half a stone that had supposedly been part of an unmortared pillar. He makes a convincing case that any stones banging around among tools in a chest and surviving the ruin of a building would be chipped and not fit together, as he puts it, as neatly as a freshly broken teacup. Although there does appear to be corroboration for stones with Indian writing being stored in that tool chest, he suggests that, In pursuit of the reward money offered, Mrs. Jett could easily have replaced the remembered stones for one manufactured by Eberhardt and his cronies. Sparks not only cast doubt on Hammond and Eberhardt, but he also pointed out ways in which Pierce had essentially invited fraud and swindlery by offering monetary incentives, and, even more damning, that he had seemingly exaggerated or misrepresented the details of his own investigations into the stone's authenticity. To wit, one of the other finders of stones in Georgia, known friend of Eberhardt, I.A. Turner, had apparently been promised some pay by Pierce and told Sparks he planned to sue Pierce over the matter. Turner insinuated that if the stones were hoaxes, Pierce knew all about it. Sparks also indicates that Pierce's investigation of Eberhardt's background actually turned up some suspect past behavior, such as the fact that he had actually sold bogus Indian relics to an antique dealer in the past. Pierce allegedly left this bit out of his writings to the Post, and when Sparks finally met up with Eberhardt himself, finding the man in a shack, sick and intoxicated, he learned of another detail Pierce had glossed over. The way Pierce told it, the fact that Eberhardt had taken an interest in the hill where his stones were discovered rather than the full $500 reward proved he was on the level. However, in 1940, Eberhardt had sold his share of the hill back to Brenau University for $1,400, which along with other remuneration for stone hunting amounted to far more than the original reward. It would seem Eberhardt was a savvier businessman than Pierce represented him to be. Moreover, while Pierce had characterized the hill as uncultivated, Sparks reports that a local farmer grew cotton on it and, when shown photos of the stones, asserted he'd never seen them there before. And as perhaps the most ridiculous aspect of Eberhardt's story, Sparks points out the overwhelming coincidence that only Eberhardt had found stones even when other, more learned men were searching the same areas, and that by the end, Eberhardt was finding them conveniently quite near his own home. Turning his attention back to discrediting Pierce himself, Sparks dug through reports on scientific testing and found that Pierce had even ignored some findings by his own experts, who had pointed out that letters had been carved to purposely avoid disturbing lichen, and some even appeared to have been carved as recently as a few days or weeks earlier. Moreover, Pierce appeared to have purposely misrepresented expert evaluations of the stones to say they could not be reproduced through shortcut methods, when in fact it seems any stonecutter might have accomplished the same engraving using a variety of modern methods. Furthermore, Pierce's claims that the language on the stone was altogether consistent with Elizabethan English conveniently ignored the exceptions made by linguists that a few words, including primeval, appeared wholly anachronistic. Perhaps most damning was Sparks' uncovering of Pierce's correspondence with the film director Cecil B. DeMille, which indicated that he did indeed seek to sell his new history to the filmmaker in the form of the rights to a different play from Greene's, one he had co-written himself based on the story related by the Eberhardt stones. After Sparks's Saturday Evening Post article, titled Writ on Rock, was published, Bill Eberhardt contacted Pierce's mother, wife of Brenau University's president, and requested a meeting, which she agreed to, thinking Eberhardt wanted to show her a new stone. And lo and behold, he did have a new stone to show her, but this one was inscribed with a threat. "Pierce and dare historical hoaxes," it read. "We dare anything." Eberhardt informed Mrs. Pierce that he would release the stone to the Post as proof of forgery unless the Pierces gave him $200. Pierce received this message from his mother, and whether or not the fact that Eberhardt had indeed forged his stones came as a shock to him, it undoubtedly was received with despondency, for the jig was up. Pierce went to confront Eberhardt with a witness, and Eberhardt reportedly received them with a rifle laid casually and menacingly across his lap, bidding Pierce to keep his distance. Pierce demanded something in writing before he would surrender the money, but Eberhardt would sign nothing incriminating. Afterward, with only the corroboration of his witness to validate his claim, Pierce went to the press and made the front page of the Atlanta Journal on May 15th, 1941, with the headline, "Hoax Claimed by Dare Stone's Finder in Extortion Scheme, Dr. Pierce Charges." The effect of the Post and Journal articles was to turn the Dare Stones into a nationwide laughingstock and destroy Pierce's academic reputation and career. Although Eberhardt denied Pierce's allegations, saying that he'd never forged any stones, but rather found them where Pierce had told him to look, the matter of the Dare Stones was laid to rest in the court of public opinion. For the next 70 years, the Dare Stones were all dismissed as hoaxes. However, recent interest in the original Dare Stone, the one presented to Pierce at Emory by Hammond, has once again cast doubt on accepted history and weakened these certainties for some. These doubts were raised by, of all things, a History Channel docudrama released in 2015. The program follows a couple of stonemasons, the Vieira brothers, who are best known for a previous History Channel special attempting to prove the existence of an extinct race of giants, a conspiracy theory previously covered by one of the Vieiras in a TED Talk that was subsequently removed by its YouTube curator as pseudoscience. In their special on the Dare Stones, they investigate on behalf of the Lost Colony Center for Science and Research, a rather sensationalist society that pursues a variety of theories in regard to the colony's fate, some more outlandish than others, such as that the colonists relocated as part of a secret operation to harvest sassafras, a crop valued as a curative for such ailments as syphilis. The film goes into detail telling the story and has the brothers examining the stones. Of course, they find that Eberhardt's stones were likely engraved using a drill press, while the first stone's lettering is, they suggest, more consistent with chisel work. More interesting, though, is the claim of one Dr. Kevin Quarmby, presented as an expert linguist in the program, and indeed his credentials seem appropriately impressive, although his background appears to be more in the area of Shakespeare and early modern drama rather than linguistics per se, that the word ye, with a superscripted e, which has long been taken as a second-person personal pronoun, as in you, is actually representative of the written form of the definite article the, which would seem to indicate either authenticity or a counterfeit of such genius that the forger was actually better versed in Elizabethan writing than the Harvard professors who evaluated his work. This assertion has led Brenau University, which remains the keeper of the stones, to call for renewed academic examination of the first Dare Stone, which in turn necessitates a closer study of its purported discoverer, the enigmatic Lewis E. Hammond. Hammond, who claimed to have been traveling with his wife when he discovered the stone, though no one ever saw her, turned out to be something of a phantom. Due to their immediate suspicions of a hoax, Pierce and his associates at Emory University had tried to tail him one night, but were eluded. On another occasion, they tried to collect fingerprints from a glass, but to no avail. Pierce even claimed to have hired Pinkerton detectives to investigate his background, and no evidence of the man's existence was ever turned up. Likewise, the Vieira brothers of the History Channel special hired their own investigator to track down proof of a Lewis E. Hammond's existence in California at that time. Tantalizingly, the investigator found proof of a Lewis Hammond who served time in Folsom Prison around that time for forgery, but the age of this prisoner seems to be different from that of the Hammond who brought in the stone, according to descriptions, so the connection remains indefinite. It appears that at least in one regard Hammond told the truth, for the fact that he hailed from California seems to have been confirmed. After leaving Georgia for home, Hammond wrote from somewhere in Alameda, California, with a P.O. Box return address, suggesting that Pierce and Emory University charge 25 cents to view the stones. To Emory University administrators, this proved Hammond to be a fraud. So Pierce had thereafter been obliged to take the stone to Brenau University, where his father was president and various other family members served as administrators and faculty, a move that would further discredit him to Boyden Sparks. It did appear, however, that Hammond just wanted some cash for his find. And after managing to obtain a weak reference from some jewelry store owner that confirmed little more than that indeed Lewis Hammond existed, Pierce and Brenau University gave Hammond some money for the stone, and Hammond thereafter vanished. But was it possible that Lewis Hammond was in league with known forger Bill Eberhardt? One account suggests, at least, that this was not so. According to Boyden Sparks, it appears that Hammond stuck around long enough to be aware of the Eberhardt stones, and Eberhardt's co-conspirator, Turner, claimed to have been approached by Hammond and asked to find a stone with the word Yahoo on it. This, apparently, was an attempt to prove that Eberhardt and his friends would turn up a stone with any word asked for, thus demonstrating their stones to be hoaxes. However, Turner and Eberhardt did not take this bait, and Pierce, unfortunately, took this as further proof that Eberhardt was in earnest. So I suppose it is still possible that Hammond and Eberhardt's crew were working together to convince Pierce of the stone's legitimacy, but such an elaborate con strains credulity. Nevertheless, the questions remain. Was the first Dare Stone a fraud, as the ensuing stones turned out to be? Was Hammond that same huckster known to be planning similar pranks around the Manteo area during the premiere of Green's play? Or was he perhaps a Hollywood henchman, dispatched to drum up a marketable narrative for a future blockbuster? If the first stone is genuine, then consider the implication of the inscription, that it was both left as a marker pointing to a gravesite and as a message to be carried by natives to Englishmen who would reward them with gifts. Where is the logic in its message? Or even regardless of the confusing content of its inscription, if there is any doubt as to its authenticity, shouldn't modern science be able to settle the matter one way or another? Until that time, this will remain a lapse in the clarity of history, a beshadowed corner in our historiography, an episode of historical blindness. Thank you for listening to Historical Blindness, the Odd Past podcast. This episode was written, performed, mixed, and engineered by me, Nathaniel Lloyd. I'd like to thank the Facebook groups, Podcasts We Listen To, and Just History Podcasts, as well as the Humanities Podcasters Network on Twitter, for adding me. You've helped me expand the show's reach, and I really appreciate it. If you enjoyed the program and would like to hear more thought-provoking stories from our shared past, please spread the word by leaving us a positive review on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher, and by sharing the program with any friends you think might enjoy it. Visit the website at historicalblindness.com to dig further into each story and find other products, such as links to my forthcoming novel, Manuscript Found. At the bottom of the page, you'll find links to stay up to date with our latest installments, products, and recommendations by subscribing to our RSS feed or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. If you feel moved to support our program and make it possible for us to release installments more frequently, you'll also find a page at historicalblindness.com/donate, where you can contribute a one-time donation or pledge recurring support through Patreon. All donations contribute directly to the composition and production of the program, and with enough listener support, a more frequent release schedule would be more feasible. Keep an eye out for our next episode, and thanks again for listening.